From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
China is calling for calm after a pair of U.S. bombers did an overfly of South Korea in what appeared to be a dash for the border with the North. This was Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry.
In the current situation, China hopes all sides can maintain control and restraint rather than provoking each other to escalate tension in the region. If we fall into a cycle of provocations and the buildup of tension, I think it is not in line with anyone's interests.
The ceasefire that began Monday in Syria appeared to be holding as of early Tuesday. This was the UN Special Envoy to Syria, Stefan de Mistura, on Tuesday.
Today, calm appears to have prevailed across Hama, Latakia, Aleppo City, and rural Aleppo in Idlib, with only some allegations of sporadic and geographically isolated incidents. Sources on the ground, which do matter, including inside Aleppo City, said that the situation has dramatically improved with no airstrikes. Every report we have been seeing indicates a significant drop in violence.
Meanwhile, there's apparent progress on the peace deal in Colombia. The UN Security Council Tuesday approved the Secretary General's recommendations regarding the size, operational aspects, and mandate of the UN mission in that country, including deployment of 450 unarmed observers and the establishment of operations in 40 locations. The action, reflected in its unanimous adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2307 at a meeting Tuesday morning, followed the adoption of an earlier resolution that established the UN political mission, as well as the agreements reached between the government of Colombia and the FARC, or Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The peace accord, which was signed on August 24th, seeks to end the 50-year conflict in that Latin American nation. Here in the U.S., as Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has dropped off the campaign trail to deal with a reported bout with pneumonia, President Barack Obama stepped up the proxy war on her opponent, Donald Trump.
And then you got the doctor, who just last week went on Russian state television to talk down our military and to curry favor with Vladimir Putin. He loves this guy.
But that characterization of Trump's telephone interview omits one detail. The interviewer wasn't a Russian spy or worse. It was none other than legendary U.S. talk show host Larry King, who's now the host of a program on politics called, appropriately enough, Politicking, which airs on RT and elsewhere.
What surprised you the most about running for office?
The media has been unbelievably dishonest. I mean, they'll take a statement that you make, which is perfect, and they'll cut it up and chop it up and shorten it or lengthen it or do something with it, and all of a sudden it doesn't look as good as it did when you actually said it.
Meanwhile, as President Obama himself enters the final months of his term in the Oval Office, many are talking of the Obama legacy. Among those, Danny Haifong, columnist at BlackAgendaReport.com. He just completed the 10th and final installment of his series on the Obama legacy, and we discussed that series with him via Skype from Boston this past Sunday.
We're living in a very interesting time. There are so many new and hot developments coming out of the 2016 elections. We see splits coming through the Democratic and Republican parties, defying the legitimacy of the two-party corporate duopoly. We see this new insurgent movement for Black Lives. But there's a contradictory role that the Obama administration played in these new developments, right? So the Obama administration, its whole agenda was to act as the highest expression of counterinsurgency of the Black liberation movement and the radical liberation movements of the 20th century, in that he was supposed to manage the crisis of capitalism and manage the affairs of the ruling class in a more effective way than any president could in a time where the legitimacy and the very essence of the U.S. imperialist system was in great danger in 2008. And so what he did was actually move forward the agenda of the ruling class to unprecedented levels. As you listed in the articles that I wrote in the series, he was able to do such things like wage war on civil liberties and imprison more whistleblowers than any president in U.S. history. He was able to escalate a war with Russia and China that now puts us on the precipice of a World War III scenario. He was able to destroy an African country, something that not even Ronald Reagan was able to do to Libya in the 1980s. He was able to increase the military transfers, the military weaponry transfers to local police departments 24-fold than any president prior. He was able to do all these things without mass protest, and that was the magic of the Obama administration. Having a black president, a so-called black president, in office was really meant to neutralize any effective political resistance to the rule of imperialism, and it worked out wonders until his swan song, until the last few years of his rule, where the movement for Black Lives emerged out of the daily police murders that occur against Black Americans. And the coming crisis of the two-party corporate duopoly, where the conditions that basically Obama laid for the masses are no longer really tenable. So in my conclusion, I basically write that and conclude that the Obama administration effectively managed the affairs of the ruling class, and now its system is in even deeper crisis than it was in 2008. And that is, I guess, something that we can look forward to in the coming years.
Yeah, you talk about the unraveling of the two-party system that's evident now, both the Democratic and Republican parties you just mentioned, and you write, literally, quote, "The unraveling of the two-party system and the emergence of an incipient resistance to racist policy are byproducts of Obama's rule," close quote. You know, you talk about the authorization by President Obama of the transfer of military weapons from the Pentagon to local police departments in record numbers. The failure of the Department of Justice to indict a single killer cop, not one out of hundreds, and that keeping statistics of the murders was not the job of the federal government. You know, we're looking at a national phenomenon here. They're the only ones with national jurisdiction. And, you know, the response to that, which was what's called the Black Lives Matter movement, also, though, you know, the example of what Obama did with the Occupy Wall Street movement looms over all of this. They carried out a nationally coordinated intelligence disruption operation that involved local police raids and charging and arresting people who were involved in that to take it down and to evict people from the spaces they were occupying, as innocuous as they were. So clearly, if they really feel a threat in Washington from the streets, that apparatus is well oiled.
Yes, and what is striking about those developments and the continuing repression of any semblance of a movement that arises in the Obama period is that Barack Obama largely escapes accountability for these, you know, heinous practices. So few in the Occupy Wall Street movement were linking the Obama administration's role in the servitude to finance capital. It was more of an ambiguous condemnation of the financial capitalist class that Occupy Wall Street focused on. And I think the same really goes for the movement for Black Lives. And these are not criticisms to condemn the movements, but I think it really shows the impact of the Obama legacy, in that even with the insurgencies that started to sprout out of the conditions of Obama rule, he and his administration were able to do things like repress the Occupy Wall Street movement and really stamp it out before it was really able to organize and take off. The same goes for the movement for Black Lives, in that most of the conditions that spurred it were a product of Obama's policy. I mean, not many people know that Barack Obama and his Justice Department actively fought against the retroactive release of prisoners under the Fair Sentencing Act in federal courts, which right. kept thousands of prisoners behind bars, despite the fact that the ruling that lowered the discrepancy between the crack cocaine sentencing laws had been effectively reduced and should have released the prisoners that were convicted of so-called drug crimes when the ratio was 100-to-1.
Right. They're litigating that. They're litigating that and not killer cops, basically, this, which shows their priorities.
Exactly. And there, of course, no cop that was killed, no cop that killed, you know, a black person and black people over the course of his rule has been given any justice. So there, you know, I think that when it comes to the legacy of Obama, what we see is a project of maintenance, a project of the ruling class trying to manage and reconcile the sharpening contradictions of its system in a manner that would buy a time to put into place policy that would quiet any resistance to its rule. And for 8 years, it did that masterfully. But now the Obama administration has left, I guess, a whole pile of mess for the ruling class to sort through in the future. And without an Obama-like figure in 2016, what we see is that the movements are gaining momentum and the crisis of the system has no way of reconciling itself, which only can lead to more resistance. So on the one hand, I think all of us at Black Agenda Report were sort of wading through the Obama mud and really struggling to to understand and to, you know, to act in this period and to stay true to our convictions. But at the same time, now we see that his departure is maybe the best thing that could happen to the movement here in the United States.
You know, lifting up the, you know, we're seeing these various pushes or presentations, essentially, of deeply held crisis of confidence in the system that we, you know, that we're the product of a lot of history. But most recent stimulus being the crash in the 2007-2008 period and what followed. And the overall decline in employment, in wages, in the membership in organized labor, and, you know, all of those trends, which have they've been ongoing, say, perhaps traced back to the late 1940s even. Mm-hmm. And so you saw more immediately a transfer of more than $4 trillion in wealth from everyone else to the 1%. And the presentation of a concept in the body politic and the adoption by the body politic of the concept of 1% versus 99%, in other words, a class division, manifestations of all of that, record foreclosures, millions of people that are housing insecure, both former homeowners and people who are renting, record numbers of evictions, foreclosures and such. Record amount of student debt, a record amount of medical debt, all of those. And then you see Occupy Wall Street and this concept starting to harden into the
political mind of the workers here of 1%, then you have this record number of people being murdered by the police, particularly black and brown folks, particularly black and brown men in their teens and early 20s, mid-20s, without any, completely without any retribution, without any justice being administered blatantly, and you see a rise of movements against that. And you also see the crisis inside the political system. You mentioned essentially the people that have lifted or had lifted Sanders and are lifting Trump up, different segments of the working class. Obama, as caretaker, I think doesn't perhaps sell exactly the reality of it, in that he's taken a more affirmative, almost aggressive stance thus far, as I mentioned, for example, in the takedown of Occupy Wall Street. What is it that, once he's exhausted his office, basically, what is it that's going to confront the next president, whether it's Trump or Clinton?
Well, I think that in my conclusion to the Obama Legacy series, it will be the thrashing of the masses that the ruling class will have to confront, given that this political hangover that us at Black Agenda Report predicted would occur after Obama's departure has taken a form that we could not have predicted. We thought, given the weakening of the left that occurred under Obama rule, that it would take time for people to come to their senses and to really digest and process exactly how effective and how impactful his counterinsurgency war on resistance really was and on policy really was. But it seems that this hangover is taking place in a way where masses of people are actually sick and tired and beginning to set themselves in motion against the very conditions that the Obama administration perfected. So in my legacy series, I talk about the mass numbers of deportations that the Obama administration carried out against the undocumented population, over 2 million immigrants deported, or whether that looks like his rapid expansion of the drone programs, or, you know, the management of dead-end capitalism, as you eloquently pointed out, all of the conditions, the misery that workers in the United States are going through, the downward spiral, the downward trend, and really many workers not knowing how to understand this process other than a blatant attack on everything that they had thought was a guarantee in the United States. And these contradictions are really heightening in this moment where a political vacuum is going to be left by the Obama administration. His marketing apparatus cannot be used in the same way by somebody like Hillary Clinton, who in 2008, the ruling class decided was not going to be the effective evil that they needed, where they pulled support away from her, basically at the last minute, to conduct a shock and awe campaign on our consciousness with the incoming Obama administration. So the Democratic Party will have to face, because I do think that the Democratic Party will unfortunately be the victors in the 2016 elections, it will have to face a period that is unlike any other, I think, in its history, where the Democratic Party has become the one party tent for the entire ruling class, and it will have to figure out how to manage though that reality. And I do not think that it will be pretty. I think that more and more people will come out and begin to fight these conditions in a way that we will have to be deeply involved in as principled theoreticians and activists on the left.
You know, in terms of deportations, for example, which you covered in the seventh part, deporter-in-chief, that policy that was implemented almost immediately by the Obama administration, wherein they have deported, as a consequence of that policy, more people than all of the other presidents combined. And they passed that mark, I think, in his fifth or sixth year. So, but that the implementation of that is left, of course, to the Department of State, which was Hillary Clinton's domain. Mm-hmm. So the policy is essentially her policy.
Yes, and the Obama-Clinton connection has been, I think, something that has not been explored to the extent that it should be. Because, you know, in the 2016 elections, I feel like Hillary Clinton has gotten a significant amount of heat, and that's a product of the Sanders development. That's a product of all of the intense investigation that she's under because of her email scandal and the her violations of federal law just operating within the state. But the connection between Obama and Clinton during those 4 years has largely been ignored. Barack Obama has been going all over the world to Laos and other places to discuss and talk about how, you know, great he's been. And he's been campaigning for Hillary Clinton ever since Sanders has dropped out of the race. And little mention has been made of how him and Hillary were a tag team for endless war, whether that be on the undocumented or whether that be on the people of Syria or Libya during that four-year period. So I think that's part of this process of coming out from the Obama period is really figuring out how we can make these connections so we can better understand the character of the U.S. imperial state. We cannot truly understand it if it remains within the confines of criticizing individual candidates. We have to start to begin to understand this system as one where the entire political apparatus is really in on protecting and forwarding the agenda of the system that's in place. And to begin to do that, the initial reaction that the masses will have will be to condemn the individuals who represent the rule of the system. Hillary Clinton represents the imprisoning of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Central American undocumented immigrants, many of them women and children. You know, Donald Trump, for example, represents the new boogeyman in new dress for the Democratic Party that has been a sort of carrot and stick game that the two-party corporate duopoly has been playing for the last 40 years. And, you know, Hillary Clinton represents basically the entire agenda of the ruling class over the last 40 years now in Democratic Party clothing. So we see a new terrain from which we have to navigate and begin to make connections that can really suppress and destroy and eliminate the misconceptions that the ruling class has been trying to foster in the consciousness of the masses ever since Obama took power in 2008.
And finally, you write, war with Russia and China becomes more possible by the day, and another economic crisis looms just over the horizon. I think in terms of policy and, you know, in the aftermath of this so-called Commander-in-Chief forum the other night, you know, their positions are very clear. And as they're demonizing Trump, one of the things they're using now is essentially
this neo-McCarthyist thing. He's, you know, too close to or a dupe of Putin and Russia, and that is the enemy, and that makes him an enemy also. That is a huge difference. And also the fact that you have a purported Democrat pointing at a purported Republican and making the charge, and having the Republican agreed with by the Republican base on the point, by the way, which I saw evidence of in Cleveland, heavy evidence of it, that the Republican base is opposed to war with Russia and China and opposed to U.S. foreign policy in terms of regime change. That's a pretty interesting dichotomy.
It is. Really, the Obama legacy can also be one that is seen as the ushering in of a one-party dictatorship of monopoly capital under the Democratic Party umbrella. And I think this whole neo-McCarthyite new Cold War rhetoric that is coming out of the bowels of the Democratic Party is really a product of just this. You know, Donald Trump is really the punching bag right now for the Democratic Party to legitimize itself in a period where it cannot dare to fight the Republican Party on policy, to fight it on its political trajectory, because what we know is that the Democratic Party has moved so far to the right, and this is what Green Party candidate Jill Stein and John Wabraka have made pretty clear, is that the Democratic Party has moved so far to the right by managing dead-end capitalism, destroying the conditions of workers in the United States, by protecting the racist police state and expanding it, by expanding the warfare state. By doing all these things, it's really pushed the Republican Party off of the political cliff and has led to someone like Donald Trump being able to fill the political vacuum with his own sort of narcissistic agenda that has, you know, ultimately inspired its grassroots base to defect from the Republican Party. And whatever we think of Trump, we have to acknowledge that point and how beneficial that really is to any alternative movement on the left to be able to struggle against what we are now seeing is really a one-party beast. It's really a fight to delegitimize and to destroy the legitimacy of the Democratic Party in order for something like a third party, Green Party, or whatever else it may be, to be able to gain traction among the masses. And so all of this neo-McCarthyite World War III, you know, provocations that are occurring in the political landscape right now is really a product of some heavy imperialist desperation. The system and the rulers of the system are pretty desperate to figure out just what is the right, just what are the right ingredients to ensure the continuation of the mass looting of the working class, while at the same time understanding that this mass looting is going to create another crash that is going to be like none other we've seen in recent years. So there's a lot to say about this current period, and I think there's a lot of optimism in it, because for the first time, I think, in the 21st century, but for the first time maybe in U.S. history, the U.S. state as we know it is really walking a path that will ensure it cannot operate in the same way. And I guess when it comes to Obama's legacy, we have to acknowledge that part of the Obama administration's counterinsurgency war was creating conditions that that no longer can be stomached by masses of people, and so we have to look at it optimistically as well as critically.
Danny Haifong is an Asian activist and political analyst in the Boston area and a columnist at blackagendareport.com. We've been discussing his 10-part series published there, The Obama Legacy, and in particular the last edition of that, in a part 10, How Obama's Past Played a Role in the Insurgency of the Present. Danny, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.